We are starting a new book today. After having finished the book of Acts last week, as is our practice, it is time now to turn our attention to the Old Covenant. And I looked through the list of books that we have studied, and I was surprised to see that we have never looked at the book of Judges. So in a sense, it's continuing our Old Covenant path, because we went through Genesis and Exodus, and I think then we did Joshua. And so now we are going to look at the book of Judges. The author of the book of Judges is not recorded, although Jewish tradition says that the author was Samuel, who was the last judge. And just the way that it is phrased inside the book, it seems like it was written by someone who was familiar with the monarchy of Israel, because it does say in a place or two that at that time there was no king in Israel, the implication being that at some time afterwards there was, at the time that it was written. The book is difficult to put in chronological order. It is not necessarily even in order of the events that occurred. Someone pointed out that the judges tend to be of different tribes, so it is possible that the writer, namely Samuel, collected together the individual accounts from the judges of the different tribes in order to make one unified account, one unified book, but hard to say. It is certainly a part of the canon, so it's an inspired book. The time period of the entire book of Judges was probably around 400 years, although there is debate over that. Some people have it as short as 200, and other people, kind of a fringe opinion, and since I tend to have some wild ideas sometimes, then I'm at least open to considering the wild concept. The wild concept is that it was actually 1,400 years instead of 400 years. The reason why that's attractive is that if it is indeed 1,400 instead of 400 years, then the archaeological evidence now snaps into place, and you have overwhelming archaeological evidence for the events in both Exodus and Judges, whereas if it's 400 years, then nothing has been found yet. It's not saying that it's not going to be found. The absence of evidence does not constitute evidence of absence, so to speak. Judges follows right after the events in the book of Joshua. So it starts soon after the Exodus. It is telling the story of what happened in taking possession of the promised land. As Paul Harvey used to say on the radio, the rest of the story of the Exodus, that Moses had taken them to the boundary of the promised land. Joshua had taken them in and conquered all the major city-states. We had mentioned in the Torah portion of the patriarchal period, they had a loose set of city-states in the land of Canaan. Things were starting to transition into a more unified sort of nation, but the Israelites were still able to conquer that. And now that takes us to Judges chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came about after the death of Joshua, the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, saying, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites, to fight against them?" The Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand." Now you've got to remember that at this point, we had moved from God speaking face to face to Moses to God appearing on occasion to Joshua, now to them inquiring of the Lord, which probably involved the Urim and the Thummim, which the high priest had. And so you see them asking certain questions that had probably yes-no answers. We don't know how the Urim and the Thummim were used, but that was probably it. So Judah was going to go up. In verse 3, "Then Judah said to Simeon his brother, 'Come up with me into the territory allotted me, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I in turn will go with you into the territory allotted you.' So Simeon went with him. Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and they defeated 10,000 men at Bezek. They found Adonai Bezek in Bezek, and fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. But Adonai Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him, and cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Adonai Bezek means the Lord of Bezek, or my Lord of Bezek. So it's probably a title, the king, the leader of it. Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to gather up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. So they brought him to Jerusalem and he died there. The sons of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it and struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. It wasn't going to stay captured, however, but they did capture it. Afterward, the sons of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country and in the Negev and in the lowland. So Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron formerly was Kiriath Arba, and they struck Shishai and Ahiman and Talmai. Then from there he went against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb, remember Caleb? One of the spies that came back and gave a good report. And God said that none would survive to enter the promised land except Joshua and Caleb. And here he is. He survived, not only survived, but he's definitely still spry. And Caleb said, the one who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I'll even give him my daughter Achsa for a wife. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it, so he gave him his daughter Achsa for a wife. Then it came about when she came to him that she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. Then she alighted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, what do you want? She said to him, give me a blessing, since you have given me the land of the Negev. Give me also springs of water. So Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. The descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms with the sons of Judah to the wilderness of Judah, which is in the south of Arad, and they went and lived with the people. Then Judah went with Simeon his brother, and they struck the Canaanites living in Zephath and utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. And Judah took Gaza with its territory, and Ascalon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. Now the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots. See if in archaeologically or anthropologically speaking, we have the transition from Bronze Age to Iron Age, and we had the valley inhabitants were more advanced technologically than the Israelites, and so they had trouble with them. So they couldn't drive them out. Then they gave Hebron to Caleb, and as Moses had promised, and he drove out from there the three sons of Anak. Right, so far, so good, but you can sort of see the things starting to turn a little bit. But the sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the sons of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. Likewise, the house of Joseph went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. House of Joseph spied out Bethel. Now the name of the city was formerly Luz. The spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, please show us the entrance to the city, and we will treat you kindly. So he showed them the entrance to the city. They struck the city with the edge of the sword, but let the man and all his family go free. Man went into the land of the Hittites and built a city and named it Luz, which is its name to this day. But Manasseh did not take possession of Bethshean and its villages, or Tanakh and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleim and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. So the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. So they didn't do what God had commanded them to do. It wasn't like they were not able to do this. It said that they were not, in their strength at that time, able to do it. But that's only because they did not increase their strength. They did not take the measures to do what they needed to do. With persistent, we saw that some of the groups of Israelites were able to, by spying out the land, by doing other things, they were able still to conquer it. But yet we have this whole list of things that they did not conquer all the way. And it continues, verse 28, came about when Israel became strong, that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. That's not what God told them to do. God didn't say, take these people to carry your wood and be your servants. God said, drive them out. Don't let them live among you. Verse 29, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who were living in Gezer. So the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol. So the Canaanites lived among them and became subject to forced labor. This is apparently an idea that spread. It's like, oh, we won't drive them out. Look at this. We can have them do our work for us. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko or the inhabitants of Sidon or of Achlab or of Achzib or of Helba or of Afik or of Rehob. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, and the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath became forced labor for them. Then the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down into the valley. Yet the Amorites persisted in living in Mount Herez, in Ajalon, and in Sha'albim, but when the power of the house of Joseph grew strong, they became forced labor. The border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah and upward, and into chapter 2. Now we saw, really, this pattern, that instead of driving them out or killing them, which is what God told them to do, instead they let them live among them, as forced laborers even, in their houses. Now the angel of the Lord, verse 1 of chapter 2, came up from Gilgal to Bochim. And he said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land which I have sworn to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And as for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed me. What is this you have done? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they will become as thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. In other words, it's, in a sense, that's God's judgment. In another sense, it's inevitable. You're letting these people live among them. They weren't dealing with them. Their gods would be a constant snare to them. And you might ask, well, why in the world is that? Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the end of this chapter. We finish what God's judgment was upon them. Verse 4, when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, people lifted up their voices and wept. So they named that place Bochim, and there they sacrificed to the Lord. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to his inheritance to possess the land. People served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. And Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. They buried him in the territory of his inheritance, in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. Remember, it's not chronological. This is really a recap of what had happened. Verse 10, all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. The sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. So they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroth. See, this is the way ancient Hebrew worked. You didn't have nice column headings and all, or section headings and titles and subtitles and all the rest of the things that we love. So the structure of the book was this quick chronological introduction. Now it's really an abstract, we'd call it, an abstract of a paper here in chapter 2, which describes what's coming in the book and the whole history of the time of Egypt. This whole cycle of disobedience followed by a deliverer, followed by disobedience, followed by another deliverer, and so on and so forth. Verse 14, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had spoken, and as the Lord had sworn to them. so that they were severely distressed. And the Lord raised up judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges. They played the harlot after other gods and bowed themselves down to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord, but they did not do as their fathers. When the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judges, with the judge, and delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed and afflicted them. When it came about when the judge died, they would turn back and act more corruptly than their fathers, following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not abandon their practices or their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not listened to my voice, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will keep the way of the Lord, to walk in it as their fathers did or not. So the Lord allowed those nations to remain, not driving them out quickly, and he did not give them into the hand of Joshua. A sad, sad, sad story as it starts and as it continues. We have this going on all through this history of the time of the judges until it reaches its culmination in some really awful things that are recorded in the last couple of chapters of the book of Judges, how all these people were acting. And the first question that you have to kind of scratch your head and say, but, you know, God had done all these wonderful things for these people. But yet at their first opportunity, as soon as they had really been delivered through this judge, they turned away. It wasn't because these other gods were more effective in taking care of their people, because these were people that were conquered by Israel. These were people that were put to forced labor by Israel. It was something that had taken me a great deal of thought over the years to try to figure out what in the world was going on, why these other things were so attractive. And usually it's talked about the young people that are called away to follow these false gods. And really, I think the secret is in understanding what the worship of Baal and Asherah was all about. It wasn't people sitting quietly in a grove singing hymns to these particular gods, but Baal made its way into either the Roman or the Greek pantheon as Bacchus, the god of wine and licentiousness and immorality, and that was the god that they were serving there in the Middle East. And their worship service was one big, drunken, immoral party. And so that was what the attraction of the gods of that land were, especially to the young people of Israel. It wasn't that it was somehow theologically more tenable to them about these gods, but rather that these gods spoke to their flesh, it spoke to their sensuality, it spoke to their sensual pleasures. And so that's why they were constantly being tempted to go away after these things and away from the fallen god. It seems to be a pattern. In some sense, following the true God is a lot easier than following this pagan idea of the immorality and the really the drunkenness and all the rest. But in another sense, it's easier in the short term. It's fun in the short term to follow these pagan practices, but you pay for it in the long term. In following God, you have to show the self-restraint in the short term for blessings in the long term, that you establish your life and your life moves smoothly. You don't have the complexities. I listened to what some of the young people are going through, particularly some of the older folks. get involved too, but mostly I hear it from the young people, the kinds of situations that they're involved in and all of the difficulties that come, that bear fruit from these things eventually, that you just want to shake them and say, look, why don't you just pick God's way? It's the easy way in the long term. It may not seem like it, but in the long term, it's the easy way. We are always fighting these religions, these philosophies that say people can do, can behave any way they want. In a sense, we can look at this pattern in the time of the judges and self-righteously sniff at how stupid they are to go through this over and over and over again. But then we look at the history, or modern history, and we see the same pattern occurring. Certainly in the history of the United States. Some of us look back on the events at the beginning of the 20th century as some sort of high watermark of spirituality. I say some of us because, you know, we still hadn't gotten things right as far as handling different people groups in the midst of this country, that if you weren't of European ancestry, it wasn't particularly a golden age. But in a sense, it was better than things had been in the middle of the 18th century. Because one of the reasons why we look back with fondness at the godliness of the beginning of the 20th century was because of the revivals of the great outpouring of the Spirit at the end of the 19th century. And going back further, there are other times when there have been fallings away and revivals and return and recovery and all the rest. And so we do the very same thing. You have a generation that comes to know God, that understands the things that God has done for us, have understand the blessings of what living a life devoted to following Him, to living righteously is like, and the blessings that come. And then there comes another generation or two that then says, I don't believe you. I just don't believe you. That's so old-fashioned. I've got this opportunity now to do this, and don't worry. You might have seen problems with this, but we've got it under control now. We know how to do this right. Pick something, you know, immorality, drunkenness, you name it. They said, we got it under control. And either they'll learn or they won't. Hopefully we can help teach, but if not, the same kind of cycles occur. The catastrophe is inevitable if you turn away from God, even as an individual or as a nation. This may take a while to happen. But really, the only real answer is to continue following Him, no matter what those around us are doing. It's hard. It's hard sometimes. It would have been hard back in the time of the judges. Hard for the people who wanted to live righteously. Everyone around them was running after the Baals and the Asherah. It's hard for us sometimes. But that doesn't mean that we can't do it. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, thank you for the victories that you have given to us. And thank you for the stories that have been passed down to us, all the wondrous ways that you have worked in our history. May we be faithful in reaching this next generation, that they might understand the true path of righteousness, and that they might crave that close fellowship with you, turning away from all evil and corruption, and instead seeking the purity and the wonder and the goodness, really the simplicity of life, that comes from following you in the grace and the mercy that is ours in our Messiah Yeshua. Amen.